It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about scientific ocean drilling and what organisms surviving in the most extreme places tell us about life here on Earth. And you can be part of the conversation as we discuss astrobiology, exploring nature in the universe and beyond. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Treadwell is a professional science communicator, special interest in astrobiology, and a Wisconsin native holding a master's degree from UW-Whitewater. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So astrobiology is the study of how life emerged and evolved on Earth and where it could exist elsewhere beyond us. Why is there this increased interest in astrobiology?
Well, I think it really comes down to basically these are the biggest questions that we have. Where do we come from, and are we alone? And I think that we have explored our solar system to the point where now we're ready to really start looking for those answers.
Is NASA into astrobiology? Like, what is NASA focused on?
Oh, yeah. NASA, most of NASA's missions have some sort of astrobiology intent behind them. So, for example, the Perseverance rover is core drilling on Mars to look for stromatolites, which is something that we knew we had on Earth, and Mars also had water. So we think it might have been also present on Mars. We have the Clipper mission coming up, which is going to be flying out to Europa to try to capture water samples that are pluming out into space from that icy moon of Jupiter.
Wow. So, in, you know, outside the solar system, astrobiologists are starting to study the atmospheres of these exoplanets. What might these explorations help us understand?
Yeah, you know, the exciting thing about exoplanets, and this just always blows my mind, is that we didn't know that there were other planets in our solar system until the 90s, you know, and now we know of over 6,000 of them. And so really, they're so far away. The only thing we can do is look at the atmospheres and see if there is biosignatures. So basically, the molecules that we know life likes, if we can see those in those atmospheres, it can give us an indication that maybe there is life on that planet, but they're so far away, that's about as much as we can do at this point.
Wow, just a little bit of clues there. So, you know, as astrobiology research includes studying how organisms live in extreme places, what are some surprising examples of how organisms live in extreme environments?
Well, there's so many cool examples. I mean, there are microorganisms that live in acid pools. There are microorganisms that live under the ice in the Arctic. You know, again, this was a discovery in the 90s. We found these vent fields down at the bottom of the ocean, and we found these thriving ecosystems. And the microorganisms are eating actually the chemicals that are coming out of the vent field. So they don't need photosynthesis because it's dark down there. They're eating the chemicals. So it's a chemiosynthesis. And then, you know, the food chain kind of moves up from there.
Wow. So turning to the summer, when you worked on the global research ship known as the Joides Resolution, the JR. So this is a ship that drills into the ocean floor to collect and study core samples. What are scientists aboard the vessel searching for in the ocean floor?
Well, it really depends on your expedition. So the ship goes on 2-month expeditions, and it's just always going somewhere around the world, and it's studying different geological things. Or in my case, we were on an astrobiology-minded mission, because not only were we collecting core samples, we were also collecting fluid samples. And what we were looking for is to basically see how far down we would find life. We know how hot microbes can survive in a lab setting, or how much heat they can survive. But we don't know what that really looks like in nature. So we were sending a really special sample tube that would capture water at different water temperatures and see what were the thermal limits of life.
Wow. What were your days like aboard the JR? Can you let us walk in your footsteps?
Oh my gosh, it was amazing. So the ship runs 24/7. It never sleeps. So people are always working on the ship, and it's go, 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 because it's, you know, it's expensive to run this. So they try to optimize as much research time as possible. But the role as the onboard communicator is really special, because I'm not stuck in one area of the ship. I get to kind of explore the whole ship and share the science that the scientists are doing to the public. And so one of the flagship things that we would do is live ship to shore broadcasts. And we're really proud on my expedition. We ended up doing 60 ship to shore broadcasts in 2 months. So we averaged one a day, which is a lot. And I would have done 60 more. But, you know, we would do Zoom. We would live Zoom with classrooms and classrooms going from kindergarten and then even like nursing homes. And we would walk through the ship and show what the ship looked like and what kind of science we were doing, which is something, by the way, that you can sign up for, and it's free.
And, you know, I was looking at the JR's website, and it shows you where the ship is right now and what the scientists are doing on board in the moment. I mean, how does this research vessel communicate science and discoveries?
Well, we have some actually, you know, really large satellites that we have to keep us connected to the world. If the weather's a little rough, we can lose some connectivity. But the internet works pretty well nowadays. We have so many satellites in space, which is pretty neat, because I've been, you know, told by other people, there were scientists who I sailed with that had done this multiple times going far back, you know, into the 80s. And they were like, oh man, you would not believe how times have changed. So, you know, it used to be, if you went on these expeditions, you'd have to use a calling card, and you'd have to dial home. And that was the only way you could talk to people. But I mean, I could FaceTime my kids from the ship.
Wow. We're talking with UW-Whitewater graduate Sarah Treadwell, professional science communicator, special interest in astrobiology. You can join in the conversation. Your questions and your insights are welcome at 800-642-1234. Sarah, how do you feel about the ship's upcoming retirement after nearly 40 years of research?
Yeah, that was really surprising news right before I left for my 2-month expedition. It was announced that the NSF had decided not to extend the contract for the last 4 years that the ship was anticipated to still be in operation. My personal feelings, I do feel bad. I feel very sad for a lot of these, especially early career research scientists, because it's going to be at least probably 10 years before we have a replacement ship. And that's a significant chunk of time for certain, you know, scientists to lose out on the ability to do their research. So it's disappointing. I definitely would say that that's my strongest feeling.
Can you explain how this ship is a model for global cooperation and how scientists work together from across the world?
Yeah, absolutely. So we had scientists from all over the globe. And while the United States is the primary funder for it, other countries can contribute, and how much money that they donate allows them a spot for a scientist to sail. And again, going back to our ship to shore broadcast, that was one of the things that was really fun, is we were doing these calls all around the world. And sometimes we would have the scientists who represented their countries come and speak. You know, they would lead a tour in French or in German. And that was really, it was really cool. And as a professional communicator, it was just really fun to kind of walk along. You know, I've done these tours so many times, so I know what they're kind of talking about, but to watch them speak in their own languages and, you know, try to figure out how to say the words in their language was really, really, it was a cool experience.
And your role on the research vessel, as you say, is to communicate to the public about science and scientific research. What is a common myth that you find about astrobiology?
Well, we're not looking for little green men on Mars. that's kind of the one thing that everyone is like, oh, aliens. You know, science, again, going back to Perseverance rover, science is based on evidence and building on that evidence. And so, like I'm saying, we knew that there was water on Mars. We knew that at the same time on Earth, there were stromatolites when we think there was water on Mars. So that's what we're looking for, because we know that it was here and there, it could theoretically have been there as well. So I think that that's probably the biggest thing. And don't get me wrong, I like talking about, you know, the aliens and like the UAP study and stuff like that. I do. I enjoy that. But when we're actually talking about like, okay, how does astrobiology research work? It's definitely looking at extremophiles, because we know that everything that we have access to in our solar system that we could possibly research is a very extreme environment. So that's what we have to look at here to understand what we might find out there.
And today we find you in North Dakota. You're studying cold weather Arctic climates with the University of North Dakota. How does this research relate to astrobiology?
Yeah, it's, you know, to me, astrobiology is one of the most interconnected sciences that has come out in all of the history of science so far. You need the geologists, you need the chemistry people, you need the physics. And so the work that we're doing in the Arctic lab that I'm doing, also science communication for them, is we're looking at the permafrost and mapping how quickly it is degrading, but they're also looking at how to improve cold weather technology. And one of the ways that they're doing that is actually looking at organism extremophiles, because they want to somehow biologically capture that ability and translated into machines. That's kind of like the simple way of putting it. But we're fascinated with these animals that have evolved to be able to live in extremely cold conditions. And so how can we make our technology better to survive cold, harsh weather as well?
Right. I mean, nothing really wants to work when it's that cold. You know, we don't want to work when it's that cold. And so
right.
Trying to make a drone more hardy and more capable of being able to do that instrumentation, I mean, that would need a technological breakthrough.
Yeah. And that's going to be important for when we go into space, because, you know, in space, when the sun is, you know, not shining on you, the astronauts, when they're wearing those big spacesuits, they're filled with little tubes of water. And when the sun is shining on them, it's 250 degrees Fahrenheit. But when the sun goes away, it's a negative 250 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, so, wow.
So those are extreme swings, right?
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Sarah Treadwell, professional science communicator, was on a research ship studying the ocean depths. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. 6th District Congressman Glenn Grothman is here as we focus on Capitol Hill in the aftermath of Republicans firing the House Speaker in the middle of the term. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Share your views along the way. 800-642-1234. Talk is right here at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Congressman Glenn Grothman, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Glad to be on your show and glad to talk to the erudite listeners of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I was waiting for that. Yes. Okay. Well, you and Wisconsin's other Republicans in the House voted against removing Speaker McCarthy. Nevertheless, McCarthy became the first speaker in history to be voted out of office. Why did you oppose ousting McCarthy?
Well, there was really no good reason to do it. He's done a good job. I think when you look at a speaker, you look both at what he did outside the building and inside the building. Outside the building, he took over. The Republicans were in a deep minority. Now we're in the majority. He's had two good cycles in a row, so he should be rewarded for that. And secondly, it would be hard to imagine him pushing a more conservative agenda through the House. You've got to remember, publicly anyway, the people who deposed him claimed that it wasn't conservative enough. But we can go into that. But he did push a very conservative agenda through. So I think the combination of the two things, he deserves to stay in there. Not only has he done a good job, but of course he's probably taken, the speaker's probably a 90-hour-a-week job. He's been doing that for 4.5 years. And to throw him out, in part, I think, because of just personal conflicts with a couple of congressmen, 8 out of 221 is a little ridiculous as well.
So put this into context for us. How is this moment different from 2015 when then-Representative Mark Meadows files a resolution to force a vote on the leadership of then-Speaker John Boehner?
Very parallel. People haven't talked about the parallels enough. John Boehner was also a very successful speaker. At that time, we had 247 Republicans in Congress, the highest number since around 1930. He had pushed, I'd say, a fairly conservative agenda at the time. Congress was voting on budgets under something called sequester, where we had budget increases much smaller than anything we've seen since then until now. So he was doing a good job, but a few people, in part, I think, to get their name out there, decided to try to get rid of John Boehner. They did not wait around for the votes. You can't say, strictly speaking, John Boehner was thrown out, but of course he quit because he thought he'd lose the vote, I believe.
So Florida Representative Matt Gaetz leads this effort to end McCarthy's speakership. Gaetz disapproving, as you mentioned, of the deal McCarthy struck with Democrats to pass a temporary funding extension and avoid a government shutdown. How do you view what McCarthy did working across the aisle to keep the government operating?
Well, first of all, nobody in Washington believes that Matt Gaetz is doing this because McCarthy talked to Democrats. He's doing it because he, on a personal level, does not like Kevin McCarthy. We don't know all the details of that. I think it goes back to a kind of a scandal involving Matt a few years back. I think he was found not guilty of anything, but I don't think he liked McCarthy's actions there. As far as reaching across the aisle, I think the American public, well, there's some people who wouldn't mind shutting down the government. Usually when that happens, the Republicans get blamed and it doesn't work out well politically. It seems to be obvious that you shouldn't shut down the government because, you know, 10 or 12 Republicans want to. The overwhelming number of Republicans, including myself, voted to keep the government open. But if we didn't have 218 votes, the only other place to get is with Democrats. By the way, for any of your conservative listeners out there, there might not be that many of them. The second last effort to keep the government open had contained two provisions. We were doing many different things in there to close the border, and we had a budget in which, or I'll refer to it as a budget, in which all the departments of the government had their discretionary departments other than Department of Defense, Homeland Security, which is the border, and the veterans, had their budgets cut by 30%. I mean, that's pretty wildly conservative. And Kevin pushed that through, or tried to push it through the House, and 21 Republicans, including most, if not all, of this group who got rid of Kevin, wouldn't vote for that because they felt it wasn't conservative enough. Can you imagine if we cut the Department of Education or the Department of the Interior by 30%? But that wasn't good enough for these guys. So Kevin was pushing a very conservative agenda, did all he possibly could to get an extension with just Republican votes. And if you have 21 people who can't vote for that, claiming it wasn't conservative enough, Kevin really had no other choice.
So this week, you told WTMJ you spoke with a member of the Freedom Caucus that had opposed McCarthy. What did you learn from that conversation?
The most interesting thing I got from it, and it was a private conversation, I don't want to say who it was, is they have no plan B. I mean, they first of all decided to get to Kevin, and then they have no particular idea who is going to wind up replacing him, which, in addition to the outlandishness of tossing out McCarthy, if you're going to do something that dramatic, you better know what's going to happen afterwards. And they had no idea. They hadn't thought about it at all.
Talking with Glenn Grothman, Republican representative from Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District, as we take a look at Congress with the ousting of Kevin McCarthy, House Speaker. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. So looking ahead here, Tuesday, House members are set to reconvene, start discussing who will be the next speaker. Representatives Steve Scalise of Louisiana, Jim Jordan of Ohio have announced bids. What will you look for in a successor?
Well, I think they've got to be somebody who can bring everybody together. I think right now, if I had a fault with Kevin, he was just doing all he could to please the Freedom Caucus. And a lot of other people, I think, were kind of ignored And we need somebody who can kind of try to get everybody together, because if the Republicans are going to maintain the majority, they all have to pay a little bit of attention to the Republicans who are getting reelected with 51 or 52%. And I think Kevin made some decisions that maybe these Freedom Caucus guys wanted him to, that put the careers of some of the folks in the close district at risk. So I want to see how they're going to handle that and whether they're going to bring up welfare as a concern in this country. I think our welfare system is broken. The Republicans seem to have forgotten that to a degree. I also hope there's a commitment made, if not this session, next session, that they do something along those lines.
But the House isn't able to do legislative work without an elective speaker. I mean, until the House Republicans start to come together and agree, you're really in a, you know, I guess a moment of just unable to do a thing.
Right. Well, it's going to be back to where we were in January. And, you know, in January, in a private meeting, Kevin was elected speaker. The tradition is that once you get elected in a private meeting with a paper ballot, everybody comes out and votes unanimously. That was not done in January, and people broke what is normally considered the golden rule. You've got to vote for the speaker in your first vote. So we will see once a vote is taken, I assume right now on Tuesday night, once a vote is taken, will everybody fall behind that vote? Or are some people on the losing end of the vote going to say, okay, now I'm going to negotiate with the elected speaker to see what else I can get? I think it's going to be harder for him to do it this time, because I think the public, or at least the Republican public, stands behind Kevin McCarthy. And if these guys couldn't vote for Kevin last January, I think they're going to have a hard time when somebody else, be it Steve, be it Jim, gets elected in there and saying this person's not good enough either. I think the public will kind of be mad at that sort of behavior.
Let's take a call. Rob in Shawano. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just talking about, I think it's a very weak thing to do as far as the party goes. And, you know, whoever they put in there, if they don't agree with them, are they going to try to oust him too? I mean, we got to come together as a Republican Party and stand strong.
Rob, thank you for that. Rob thinks this is a weak thing to do, Representative Grothman.
Well, weakens the Republican Party. I like to believe that if somebody new gets in there and a month from now people try to oust that person, there'll be a backlash within the Republican Party. They'll realize we aren't dealing with serious people. We're just dealing with permanent malcontents.
Should a House Speaker wield less power?
One of the things they extracted from Kevin McCarthy when he took over was to give up power, more power. And I'll just tell you this. The idea, it always sounds good, oh, the speaker should have less power. The speaker should have less power. I don't care where you are in life, whether it's a business, whether it's a sports team, whether it's the military. If you have a weak leader, things don't get done. So these people who say, and already I think McCarthy is a lot weaker than, say, in the state legislature, say he's a lot weaker than a Robin Voss. He's already a lot weaker, and to make him weaker, even more weak, is, I think, a big mistake.
Before we have to let you go here, Texas Republican Troy Nels proposing nominating former President Trump to be Speaker of the House. The Speaker may be a citizen rather than a member of Congress. Would you vote for Trump as Speaker?
Well, I'll just say that's an effort to get your name in the paper and an effort to suck up to President Trump. Nobody thinks President Trump is going to be Speaker.
Congressman Grothman, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be on the show.
Glenn Grothman is a Republican representative from Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.